Welcome to Morning Report Top Stories, a selection of news from Radio New Zealand National's Morning News Programme.
The government is scrambling to take a tougher line on crime in the face of extraordinary pressure, splashing cash and signalling potentially more changes to come. Dairy owners yesterday shut up shop to commemorate the slain shopkeeper Janak Patel and to call for tougher penalties for offenders. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern denies it has taken a tragedy for her to act and insists she has always been firm and fact-driven. But the community is sceptical and opposition parties appalled. This report from our Deputy Political Editor, Craig McCulloch.
This is the roar of an angry and organised community grieving the loss of one of their own. Their cry crystallising the crisis for the government and forcing action.
No one should go to their place of work feeling that they are vulnerable to senseless violence and crime.
Jacinda Ardern has been under immense pressure over the country's retail crime wave, a spate of ram raids and burglaries, and the stabbing of Janak Patel last Wednesday outside a dairy in the Prime Minister's own Mount Albert electorate.
Our job as government is to make sure that we do all we can to keep our small business owners and operators and workers safe. What we're announcing today is focused squarely on that.
The announcement offers small retailers a $4,000 payment to help cover the cost of having a fog cannon installed. When triggered, the device can quickly fill a room with vapour and emit a high-pitched noise to scare off intruders. The rollout won't be swift, though. The Police Minister, Chris Hipkins, says supply constraints and a limited workforce will hold the scheme back until at least April.
We won't be able to do this overnight.
Why somebody had to die to get the government attention?
Sonny Koschel has long advocated for dairy owners and small retailers and is sceptical of the announcement. He says the government's ram raid fund, announced in May, turned out to be a shambles, with just 8 stores having received completed upgrades. That scheme is now being extended to victims of aggravated robberies as well.
We are not holding our breath.
Councils in Auckland, Hamilton and the Bay of Plenty will also be able to access a separate new pool of $4 million, matching dollar for dollar what they spend on security measures like street cameras or lighting. The opposition parties are underwhelmed.
They're completely devoid of ideas. I was stunned.
National's police spokesperson Mark Mitchell says the government's only solution seems to be to barricade businesses.
All they've come out with is throw more money at the problem. They've already chucked $6 million in it and they can't spend that. It's just pathetic. They're a complete nutter joke.
I will not stand by and have anyone call this government soft on crime. We have been the opposite, firm and fact-based.
Jacinda Ardern denies the announcement's a knee-jerk reaction. She says much of it's been in the works for a while. But the critics say it's what's missing that matters. And that's tougher penalties for offenders.
Right now, the offenders have no fear of police, no fear of law, no fear of being caught or any consequences whatsoever.
The government's shown little appetite for tougher penalties, but it is taking a closer look at how young offenders are being treated. Ms Ardern's not convinced the police or Oranga Tamariki are currently using all the tools available to them, and she's exploring solutions. Expect another announcement then, still to come, even if not the exact one her critics want.
Now, police have announced they will increase their presence and visibility in areas that are experiencing the most harm from retail crime, following, of course, the homicide in Sandringham last week. But will it keep workers safe? RNZ understands that owners of the dairy where Janak Patel was stabbed to death approached the police twice asking for additional security and were turned down. I asked the police commissioner, Andrew Costa, about police plans to have more patrols.
Yeah, look, we appreciate the concern that exists amongst small businesses, particularly in our shopping precincts, and those are places where our police visibility makes a difference. That's not the only thing that we will be particularly focused on. Serious and prolific offenders are an opportunity for us to have a good intervention on these problems, and we'll be putting a lot of effort into that as well.
I don't often see police walking around the streets in my own experience. Usually they're in cars. Are you going to get out of the car more often and patrol the streets? Is that what we're saying?
Yeah, look, that's what we are encouraging our staff to do. Obviously, police is constantly juggling a range of priorities and, you know, we do our best to cover off all bases. At the moment, visibility in our town centres, particularly on foot, something that will make a difference to that community that's concerned.
Do we have enough police?
Look, we could always do more with more. The reality is we need all of our public services to be functioning really well to address the problems that we see. And so, you know, we do the best with what we have.
There's been a lot of talk about youth crime, but when you look at the statistics, it has fallen considerably, and it has been falling since about 2008. Is there a gap between reality and perception here?
Look, I think that's true, and at times we lose sight of the long run here, which is falling crime rate, falling youth crime rate. We have seen a short-term spike in crime affecting particularly retail businesses, and particularly in the form of ram raids and related offending. But most other offending types, including residential burglary, are below the place they were pre-COVID. And so it's a bit of a shift in offending patterns more than it's a wholesale increase in crime.
That is the Police Commissioner Andrew Costa there. I spoke to him a little earlier in the program in the morning. And the police have also this morning released a new policy on chasing fleeing drivers, or at least a new statement on this. It's a little bit opaque, a little bit hard to work through it, but Andrew Costa is saying that the changes introduced 2 years ago had seen an increase in drivers fleeing and a decrease in the number of offenders identified. He said that after police have consulted with the IPCA and the Police Association, that's the police union, and the Children's Commissioner, they will be acting on a desire for change and a perception that offenders are more brazen and more willing to take risks with their driving behaviour. He says, quote, "The revisions will bring police back to a more balanced position while still prioritising the safety of officers and the public." So if you try and unpack all that, I think they're saying that they are going to be a little more aggressive in the pursuits policy, but it's one of those press releases which does take a bit of reading between the lines.
To China now, protesters are being arrested and violently beaten up by police across many Chinese cities as residents push back against the government's zero COVID policy. Now, demonstrators say they are frustrated by the government's belief that the country can somehow stop COVID in a way, well, no other country has yet managed to. Earlier, I spoke to Lisa Movius, a journalist and long-term Shanghai resident, who says such a unified and nationwide approach to the protests is very significant.
Protests do happen in China, but they're usually in small towns. They're usually sporadic and unconnected to each other. And what is amazing is, first of all, here in Shanghai, is in one of the most affluent parts of town, a bunch of young people, just about 400 young people, spilled out to the street from midnight to 5 a.m. to just mourn and express their frustration over what happened in Urumqi with the fire on the 24th. So in the fire, there were 10 people killed. The people were locked in. They had been under lockdown for 100 days. And it's believed that the response to the fire was impeded by the lockdown barricades and so on. So people are very upset about that particular incident, and that's just sort of touched off a year of frustration over these increasingly stringent measures that a lot of China has been subject to, but places like Shanghai and Urumqi have been hit pretty much the hardest.
What has there been any response from the Communist Party and the government in terms of the zero COVID strategy? Would there be any change, or will it be cracked down on any dissent?
Well, obviously, they're cracking down. So on Saturday night, amazingly, the police were very restrained. There was a little bit of violence early on, but then the police pretty much held back and then kind of you know, pushed people away and only started doing the arrests at about 5 a.m. after most people were gone. But yesterday, the arrests were very, very aggressive. Like, they would push you hundreds of people away from the that main corner where people gathered, and then just pull someone out, beat them up and arrest them, and then rinse and repeat with, like, person after person from the crowd. It was, we'll have no idea how many were actually detained in Shanghai alone. And of course, there are more and more of these protests all over the country with the same themes of anger at zero COVID, frustration with the lockdowns, and sadness, and really an outpouring of just emotion about what happened in Urumqi, as well as an event in September when there was a bus taking people to quarantine that went off a cliff and everyone died. So these sort of things have just been painting up. The lockdown in Urumqi was loosened, and so the people are more able to go about their lives a little bit compared to a few days ago. However, here in Shanghai, the particular COVID controls have gotten stricter. They've gone from needing a test every 72 hours to every 48 hours. So it seems like they're trying to, like, the release on one side, but then they close in on the other.
The protest, as you say, had been spontaneous around the country. Has there been communication about the protest, or is that being censored?
Things go up on the Chinese social medias, which are WeChat and Weibo. Usually these things get censored right away, but either it's the sheer volume of posts, or it was happening over the weekend, or because the censors themselves are frustrated with zero COVID, a lot of things have actually stayed up for either indefinitely or much longer than you would expect. And the main symbol of this whole thing is that people have been holding up these blank A4 sheets of white paper to symbolize that you can't say anything in China anymore. And so they're trying to censor the blank papers even. There's a rumor that may or may not be true that stores are being told to not even sell white paper at this point.
And for foreign media and for media like yourself, what is the approach here? Because there have been reports of BBC journalists who were allegedly manhandled by officials. Clearly some foreign media are nervous about reporting this. How do you approach it?
No, it's a very risky situation to go out on the street, because normally as a foreigner and with a J visa, you're expected to be to have that kind of accreditation from the Chinese government respected and protected. But the police yesterday at the site on Urumqi Lu in Shanghai grabbed this journalist and beat him up and took him into detention for a couple of hours. And, you know, he's been released, but he sustained a lot of injuries. You know, it's a pretty shocking thing to happen in China, even though we're monitored quite a bit here as foreign press. You know, we're expected to at least be physically safe. And this has really crossed a line.
The difficulty that China now faces, because having had zero COVID in New Zealand, we can understand that because we had a similar policy for some period as well. We've since well and truly moved on. How do you think China is going to deal with this issue, given if they relax the zero COVID policy, the size of the population may mean obviously a very dangerous COVID outbreak?
Right. Well, that's the billion person question, because they haven't really pushed vaccination very aggressively in older people. And so the role for the rate of vaccination for older Chinese people is very low. And the vaccines they've been using have mostly been the Sinopharm, which are not so effective. And so if they were to lift things, you know, really quickly and to sort of go back to quote unquote normal, you know, it would cost a lot of lives.
And that is journalist and longtime Shanghai resident Lisa Mavis speaking to us there.
A review of retirement in New Zealand has identified big inequities in how New Zealanders experience the later years of life. The Retirement Commission says fewer retirees are living in houses that they own, and many are struggling to afford food and to afford rent. Here's Felix Walton.
Retirement Commissioner Jane Wrightson says a comfortable retirement isn't a sure thing anymore.
We're trying to bust the myth of the dominant narrative of retirement, which is a wealthy-ish person owning their own home with sufficient capital to live quite comfortably. That's 50% of the population, give or take a bit, and that's going to decline over the next 10 or 20 years.
Roughly a third of retirees are renting their homes, a number that Jane Wrightson expects will double by 2048. She says the review focused on Māori, Pacifica and women, groups with the lowest savings.
It's because they have, generally speaking, earned less over their working life. They've suffered more than the normal life shocks. They will have taken time out from the workforce for caregiving.
She says it's particularly important for these communities to keep the age of eligibility for NZ Super at 65 to avoid further inequality. But that money isn't going as far as it used to, with more retirees taking on debt. Natalie Vincent is the chief executive of Ngā Tangata Microfinance, a provider of low-interest loans. She says many of her clients are retired.
We've seen an increase in the last 12 months of people applying to Ngā Tangata Microfinance for a small loan to either pay off some unmanageable debt or to purchase something. And in the last 12 months, that's increased by nearly 50% for that age group.
Natalie Vincent says retirees often take out loans just to pay for the daily essentials.
We're talking about debt for having to purchase things that they need. It could be car repairs, it could be a car loan, whiteware, because we're seeing more and more people who are reaching retirement age that actually don't have any savings. They don't have a nest egg.
61% of Ngā Tangata's elderly clients are women. Retirement Commission Policy Director Susie Morrissey says retired women struggle a lot more than men.
Women on average have 20% less in their KiwiSaver than men at all age groups, so from the under-17s through to the people who are over 65.
She says a combination of factors, including the gender pay gap, make it harder for women to save for retirement. All of this while housing gets more expensive. Susie Morrissey says retirees are spending far too much on their accommodation.
The current situation is that renters in the 65 to 74 age group, two-thirds of them are spending 40% of their New Zealand super on housing. And within that group, 40% of people are spending 80% of their superannuation on housing costs.
The Commission is recommending that the accommodation supplement be more accessible. The cash asset test, which determines someone's eligibility, hasn't been adjusted since the 90s. Natalie Vincent says raising it would be a game changer.
It's just not high enough. People paying a huge percentage of their super toward private rent if they're in that position. An accommodation supplement increase would actually alleviate a large amount of that financial pressure, put some money back into that person's weekly budget.
The Commission says resolving pay inequity and housing costs needs the government and the private sector to work together.
A hazardous substances inspector says WorkSafe took weeks to visit two sites that were identified as storing potentially catastrophic amounts of explosive substances. One of the companies was described as a, quote, onshore whakaari. Anusha Bradley reports.
The hazardous substances company Dangerous Goods Compliance, or DGC, inspected a Bay of Plenty company in February. Its owner, James Dunphy, says his certifier was alarmed when he found dozens of LPG bottles stored inside a warehouse.
So we had 1,500 kg potential of LPG inside a building that were at various stages of venting naturally into the atmosphere. So we had a colossal potential explosion risk, which we described internally as onshore Whakaari Island.
DGC refused to issue the business a compliance certificate and instead immediately alerted WorkSafe, as is required by law. It took WorkSafe 3 weeks to visit the site. WorkSafe says it didn't need to act sooner because DGC was helping the company, something James Dunphy says was incorrect, and he had told WorkSafe as much. He says it's not the first time WorkSafe has failed to take timely action. In August, DGC inspected another property at the request of a landlord who was worried about large quantities of flammable chemicals being stored by a tenant.
Overall, he found excessive quantities, I mean materially in excess of the allowable quantities, stored in container sizes that were as much as 10 times the lawful maximum storage size. And then a whole series of other material compliance issues that really create a very significant fire risk at the premises.
The business also had no compliance certificate, no fireproof storage, and no fire extinguishers, all required by law. Alarmed, the landlord, who RNZ has agreed not to name, rang WorkSafe to alert them to the situation.
I rang them and I said, I think you need to get there and check. He said, well, I can't get there for at least a month. And I said, well, I think it needs looking at, you know, faster than that. And he said, we're like everyone else, we run off our feet.
WorkSafe turned up 4 weeks later. 3 months on, the business still doesn't have a compliance certificate. WorkSafe again says it didn't act sooner because it thought DGC was helping the client. But Mr. Dunphy says he was employed by the landlord to do an inspection, not by the client to fix the problem. He says WorkSafe was too slow to act.
So WorkSafe data is that three times as many people as die on the roads in New Zealand every year are dying from diseases associated with hazardous substances at work. So on top of that, then we have the dreadful risk that we will have another massive event. So yes, I have significant worries that an ineffective regulator is actually going to be contributing to these risks.
WorkSafe wouldn't agree to be interviewed for this story. In a written response, it says it doesn't need to assess every site where a certifier raises an issue and may only become involved when concerns are not easily resolved.
Health bosses are worried patients won't turn up to emergency departments when they need to because of long waits and overcrowding. EDs and most main centre hospitals are working at winter levels of busyness at the moment, and there have been some high-profile incidents of people leaving before they're seen and getting sicker or even dying. GPs say some patients are avoiding emergency departments but urge them not to make that call alone. Here's our health correspondent, Rowan Quinn.
EDs and their woes have certainly been on the minds of these people, but would it stop them going?
If I had seriously cut myself and was hemorrhaging seriously, something like that, then yeah, definitely I'd go.
I don't think I would, because they're just so useless. Then you sit up there for hours and hours and hours and hours before you even get seen.
Oh, I'd go. Only if I have something seriously wrong. It's no good going with bumps, bruises and toothache.
We always have this joke at home, there's always a long way to ED. We're about to do something that could be potentially dangerous. Are you sure you want to do that with that chainsaw, etc.?
Auckland GP Marianne Heather had a patient who went to Middlemore at 6 o'clock one evening last week and didn't leave till 7 the next morning. Stories like that get around.
Well, coconut wireless is pretty good. You know, it's like people talk, people see stuff. They talk in the community, they talk at church, they talk at home. So, you know, a lot of our community know what is going on.
People not turning up does play on the mind of Te Whatu Ora bosses, like medical lead Pete Watson.
Look, I think we've been really clear that when people have urgent emergency needs, they absolutely need to come. So a lot of our messaging to the community is please make sure you come if you need help. Our hospitals are there, they're there 24/7. If people are sick, they will be triaged, and if they need to be seen, they'll be seen first.
But that message also includes a reminder not to turn up to ED unless you're an urgent case. Dr. Heather says that can be a tricky call for people to make.
When you're feeling unwell, it's really hard to make that decision. You know, everyone that feels unwell, they feel that it's urgent, you know, in their minds it's urgent. And so until you go, you don't know. But then the deterrent is people hear that message and then they don't want to go, and so they're sitting on heart attacks and strokes and other things at home.
Monica Nua-George is the clinical director of Air to Pacifica in Christchurch.
We've got a handful of that that have gone to ED and waited too long, probably more than 3 hours, and then they left.
She says in those cases, the hospital followed up with the clinic to let it know, and the patients were able to be treated in the community. Both doctors say they try to have a clear plan about when to go for patients with conditions that may deteriorate. Porirua GP Brian Betty says when it comes to making a call, seek help where possible.
There is Healthline. There is the regular GP, if they have access to that, to get advice on. However, if they're uncertain about it and they can't get any advice on what to do, they should in fact probably ring an ambulance and err on the side of caution.
Te Whatu Ora's chair, Rob Campbell, visited Middlemore's ED at the weekend. He says the busy workers took the time to tell him about the pressures they're under, staff shortages and pay, and he says the board wants to help.
Crime is a big issue in this by-election for Hamilton West. Waikato is the police district with the highest individual number of ram raids, 39 ram raids from June to September, and 16 between September and October this year. Funding isn't the only issue. It's getting help where it's needed. It has been one of the region's biggest challenges. Let's talk now to Paula Southgate, who is the mayor. Kia ora, good morning to you.
Kia ora, good morning.
This announcement yesterday, I guess one of the ones that you're looking at is this $4 million fund that's going to support councils in Auckland, Hamilton, Bay of Plenty, other areas like that. Are you going to benefit from this, and in what respect?
Oh, definitely. We've been around the $1 million of that will come to us. And we've been working with the police, the University of Waikato and other key stakeholders for some time, identifying the gaps in what's going on here in some of these horrible crimes and how we may work together to tackle them. So we had already put to the government around 45 actions that if they brought funding to the table that we could really crack on with, if you like, get done much faster, that could play a part in reducing the number of these really orphan crimes.
Yeah, let's not run through 45 of them, but no. Give us your top three or, you know, three or four.
Some of them relate to all the physical things like cameras, including number plate recognition cameras, which would enable the police to pick up stolen vehicles that are on their way to do another crime and those kind of things. Some of them relate to the ways that we could keep shopping areas safe, and some of those relate to youth in terms of youth that are on the fringes of being involved in crime, very, very young children in some cases, and how we can work as a community to ensure they don't choose crime as their life career. And we've also been talking about custodial arrangements for the worst of the offenders in terms of how would you set up something where they could go that had a lot of support around them to try and get them to make better choices for their future life. So there's a whole range of things from youth mentors to safety cameras.
Mm. How far is $1 million going to get you, Paula?
Look, any money at the moment is better than no money, but will this fix the problem? I don't think so entirely. I think there's a lot more conversation yet to be had. I think the issue around how the youth court functions and what we do with youth who become repeat offenders is a live conversation yet to had, and this $1 million probably won't touch that very much.
Mm. Nationals calling for tougher sentencing and more repercussions, I suppose, is the argument from the centre-right and those who are more conservative on these issues. Mm. Their argument is that these people don't see any repercussions for their actions. What do you think of that argument?
Well, I think in some instances they're right, but you have to make a differentiation between a 12-year-old and a 17-year-old, don't you? A 12-year-old is a child and should be at home, should be at school, should be fed, should be in sport, all of those things that we know keep children on this narrow, and they're not. There's a lot of complex issues around truancy. A lot of children haven't gone back to school since COVID. That's a real problem. So this is a multi-complex issue, if you like, but it's also an intergenerational issue.
Do you feel it? What's your perception, your own perception as you walk around your city? I mean, do you feel more aware of crime and more at risk?
Oh, look, I generally feel safe walking around our city because, you know, crime does happen in cities all around the world, no matter where you go, no matter where you travel. And I never feel at imminent risk. But I do feel concerned every weekend that I have off. I think, you know, like if I go away and spend some time with friends, I'm thinking, oh, gosh, I hope I don't come back to news of 7 ram raids or worse. I mean, my heart goes out to the family of the gentleman that was killed because there, but the grace of God goes everyone with these types of crimes. And that's why I have been lobbying government for the last 2 months really, really strongly, giving us some funding to help us do something to address this problem.
Just finally, what do you make of the government's response? I mean, is it enough?
I think we're going to have to sit down together and work through where the gaps are. This is what's happening. There's obviously gaps in the system that are allowing repeat offenders to do what they're doing. And I was just listening to the article before on police being able to chase and vehicles and things. Mm. So all of these issues are part of the story that we have to digest together. But look, communities will not be able to tackle crime without government partnership. It's that simple.
Thanks for your time this morning. Paula Southgate there, the mayor in Hamilton there.
You've been listening to Morning Report Top Stories from RadioNZ.co.nz.